It's time to think bigger.
Elias Pettersson scores!
And think bolder.
Matthew Tkachuk, what a goal!
This is Rintoul and Sermon.
Another chance, great save by Markstrom.
Here is shot, rebound, great save by Dimko.
On the Sportsnet Radio Network.
What's going on? How's your Monday? Hope you had a great weekend. Hope you're off to a great start to your day. We're going to make it better. That's what we do. Scott Rintoul, Karen Sermon with you. How was your weekend, Karen?
My weekend was pretty good. It's got a little low-key yesterday. Got my second vaccination shot on Friday.
Congrats.
Didn't have the initial 24 hours that I had the last time around with the first shot. There was no cold and flu and shivers and kind of down and out for a bit. But yeah, just slowing me down a little bit, so it took a little easy. How was it for you, though? You know, belated Father's Day to
you.
Oh,
thank you. Yeah, appreciate that.
Hopefully
no, it was great.
Family and or alone time?
It was a good combination of both. It was a very good combination of both. Thank you. And the other fathers out there can relate to that. Hey, here's a little bit of time for you, whether that's golf, whether that's doing something you want to do, go for a bike ride in my case. But, yeah, I got a lot of family time in yesterday, so thank you very much for that. But you just mentioned it. Hey, part of your weekend was getting a second dose of the vaccine, and that's kind of where we left the show on Friday. And where mm-hmm. we begin, at least potentially, what a weekend in the National Hockey League. The storylines were all over the place. COVID, overtime, goalie stories, officiating stories once again. I don't know if COVID's the most interesting place to begin, but we left this show on Friday saying, all right, there's irregularities with Dominique Ducharme's test. But we've seen that before and the way things have been going, and apparently he's had his second dose, so hopefully he's behind the bench. Not so much. In isolation, not coaching the Montreal Canadiens, and then we get a second positive test over the weekend, this one affecting the Vegas Golden Knights.
Yeah, Kelly McCrimmon apparently testing positive. I guess he is, I'm assuming he's with the team, so I guess he's probably isolating in a Montreal hotel room right now. They are coming back to Montreal. We'll get into that for a game six, so I guess he can just pick up with the team. Dominique Ducharme, like, you think you lose your head coach to COVID protocols, and he's been vaccinated. He's not past that 14-day double vaccination, you know, you've got your 95% immunity type of thing, but he does have a positive test. And in a playoffs, the interim head coach has done a wonderful job to get this unexpected team to the brink of the Stanley Cup finals in terms of the semifinals of the NHL playoffs. But I think that's probably the least of the stories to come out of the weekend, Scott, in terms of importance and what happened and coaching decisions and, you know, coach goalie gaffes, goalie changes, officiating. I mean, unfortunately, I still think officiating is probably the biggest story, but you would think that COVID, you lose your NHL head coach and that'd be the biggest story. And you know what? That seems to probably be fourth on the list at this point in time.
Well, and the general manager's not doing much right now, but the fact that Kelly McCrimmon is a second person in this series to test positive, it means that there has been exposure. And this is the part where, look, I know a lot of places are moving past this and life must go on, restrictions opening up. It's a pretty good reminder that things can still happen. And the backdrop for all of this, Karen, I want to get into the hockey, but the backdrop for all of this is that we're all kind of waiting every day now to see if anybody's been added to the NHL protocol list, the COVID protocol list. Does anybody have to sit out? Because this series could be derailed. A series next week in the Stanley Cup could be derailed because of this. We just don't know.
And, I mean, this is like the NHL's nightmare scenario, right? Like, I mean, the possibility of them having to delay any sort of Stanley Cup semifinals or finals because of COVID cases, you know, an outbreak could happen. Like, from what we know is the Montreal Canadiens have had their second doses, the ones that chose to, on January 9th. So, again, they're within that 14-day period after their dose. But it could be a nightmare. Hopefully it's just associated to these coaches. But Scott, so far we know is that no players are on the COVID-19 protocol list. I mean, we cross our fingers every day that stays the same. But I mean, this is not over. Like, we're still in the middle of that pandemic, right? It's a lot better than it was, but it's still affecting the entire world. We've seen it affect the Euros, which are on right now. Of course, Spain's starting their tournament without their captain. They had to be in isolation. You know, it's affecting things for the Olympics. So this is just a reminder, I think, to everyone just to be like, okay, not just athletes, but we're still in the midst of this. And even if you're vaccinated, there is a chance that you can get test positive.
No easy segue out of that, but the last couple of games in that series between Montreal and Vegas, which, like the other series between Tampa and the Islanders, both tied at two now, both best of threes all of a sudden. They are reminders that anything can happen. If you went on balance of play, Vegas should have won on Friday. Montreal should have won yesterday. And the exact opposite thing happened. And Friday, Marc-Andre Fleury's gaffe in that game, and there were other moments, but that's the one that caught the most attention because Montreal just didn't look like it was going to have it that night. Vegas, better team for the majority. Yeah, they're trying to push at the end, but Vegas is doing a good job shutting it down. And Marc-Andre Fleury makes one of those type of gaffes. MAF goes WTF, if you will. Like, what's going on here? It's just a mishandle. Josh Anderson pots it. Here we are. We're off to overtime. It ends on what is a brilliant goal by Josh Anderson. Taking that pass to the blue line, knocking it out of midair, and then he and Byron go in, and he gets the pass back. It was a great goal to win the game, but everybody's talking about the goaltender afterwards.
Yeah, so two things here, Scott. Like, Josh Anderson gets off the snide, and the way that he gets off the snide is the fact that it has to be a right place, right time. Marc-Andre Fleury fluky doesn't play the puck properly. It bounces off the back end boards to a Josh Anderson again, streaking across. Like, he was coming right across in front of the net, almost flew by the net and missed the puck, and he gets it in. Then he scores the overtime winner. What are we talking about? Okay, he's finally got it. This is what they need, the Montreal Canadiens. They're getting contributions from somebody else. You know, they're finding the big guy that they paid to come in and play playoff hockey, who's played pretty well in this series. Like, don't get me wrong, just hasn't found the back of the net. But it's Marc-Andre Fleury and the decision that he makes to go play the puck. And did you hear on the broadcast just moments before, like, Craig Simpson and Chris Cuthbert were just lamenting the fact of how good Marc-Andre Fleury has been in the series, in that game, in handling the puck, and how it's like a fifth defenseman out there. It's just great. And he goes and he does a Mike Smith on everybody out there. Like, it's just something you don't expect from Marc-Andre Fleury. He's visibly upset. He apologizes to the bench in the aftermath of it. Just not something you see from him. And it's kind of changed the direction of the series to a point in terms of now we've got a goalie to controversy with the Vegas Golden Knights.
Well, and that's the story that we will get into in the second hour of the program. David Amber will join us, and we can even put that out to our listeners now. We'll get into the Robin Lehner aspect of this. Mark, like, who do you start in game five? There's a good argument to go either way, and if you heard Pete DeBoer after the game yesterday, he left it open that he could go either way based on the way he portrayed his comments. There is a commonality between Game 4 and Game 3 as well, because it didn't look like anything was going to get past Marc-Andre Fleury. It didn't look like there was going to be any problem for Vegas finishing that out. I would have put money down in the third period yesterday that Carey Price was coming home with the goose egg. That one goal looked like it was going to be enough. It really did. And the goal that beat Carey Price, how many times does that go in on him from Braden McNabb? I don't know.
Yeah, he wants that one back.
And yet he's in very good position. It's one of those ones that just kind of slips through. He was so good. Montreal was in complete control of that game. And so, yeah, they didn't get the result in either game that they thought they were going to get the result in. But this series is where it should be, isn't it?
I think so. I think, Vegas on paper is the more talented team. I mean, that's not even arguable. You look at the talent that they have with that roster and you think, okay, they should be winning this series handily, but they're not. Montreal Canadiens are playing a perfect game. They're playing the underdog role. They have belief in themselves in that locker room. They're playing a very structured game, Scott. Last night, they outdangered Vegas, 18-0 in regulation? Like, that's almost incredible in terms of Vegas didn't get one high danger chance. And Montreal Canadiens, again, not as talented on paper, but they were the ones dictating play. It's nice to see that Montreal got rewarded for kind of sticking with it in game three. They take the 2-1 series lead. And then Vegas, you know, for all intents and purposes, was not the better team on the ice last night. But again, this team does keep coming, and they kept coming and coming. And yes, they do get a soft goal in terms of what that Paul Byron goal, but this is, you know, now a best of three series, going back to Vegas. I think if you're Montreal Canadiens, you're actually pretty happy where you are in this situation.
Well, the weird thing is there are two forwards who have scored for Vegas in this series. That's it. They've gotten contributions from their blue line all over the place. We would have thought it was the reverse, wouldn't we? Hey, Montreal, I don't know what they're going to get from their forward group, but they're going to get something from their back end, despite the numbers telling us otherwise coming into this series. Vegas' blue line has been great. Their forwards have barely done anything.
And if I was to tell you, Scott, that the Vegas Golden Knights would be tied 2-0 in the or 2-2 in this series, and your goals from your forwards are from Nicolas Roy, I think I called him Nicolas Roy, I anglicized it on Friday show, Nicolas Roy, and Janmark, like their top line, they have shut down that line, William Karlsson and his line, Marchessault. they have not been able to figure out anything, and they were so good against Colorado. Like, they were so dynamic. Mark Stone, what is that, single point? I think Max Pacioretty has 2 points now with that assist, just assists, though, assist in that overtime goal. So it's like, you think if you're Montreal, you think you're in a pretty good situation right here. I guess 2-2 is a very good situation against the team that's expected to roll you, but you have to think, like, you're doing almost everything right to try and beat this Vegas Golden Knights team, and you're still tied 2-2.
Well, and this is part of the story. Vegas comes out of Friday saying, we let one get away, but we feel pretty good about where we're at. Yeah, we're down 2-1, and yet they laid an egg for the most part in the game. Montreal was the far better team on Sunday, and so now Montreal is singing from that hymn book. I know we lost the game. That goal is not going in on Carey Price again. We got a little bit unlucky here. We keep playing this way. We're going to be the team that comes out of it. The goaltending is a big part of it, and Robin Lehner was after it after the game. I love Robin Lehner. I love listening to him at the podium. I don't always agree with everything he says, but he's somewhat unfiltered, and he was yesterday. Final question of his availability was about, hey, that's a pretty gutsy move by your head coach, with all due respect to your game. Mark Spector went through this preamble about, look, I'm not trying to discount you here, but Marc-Andre Fleury's been playing great in the playoffs. What does it mean to you to get that vote of confidence from your head coach to move into this series right in the middle of it? Here's where Robin Lehner went with the answer.
No, it was great. You know, not many people know. You know, I come to the game 4 hours early. I get up my own bus, come 4 hours early. I sat for 2 hours and watch you guys talk shit on Twitter on me, you know, to get me motivated. And, you know, it was great, you know, just to see all what you guys had to say. And
all I keep thinking is when I hear that, Scott, is the meme or gif of Michael Jordan saying, and I took this personally. Like, it's like he seems to have manufactured something in his mind, and I don't know what he read, because I don't know about you, but what I saw on Twitter was a not basically a condemnation of Lehner being in, but it was like, well, but Marc-Andre Fleury's played pretty well. Is this a desperation reactionary move by Pete DeBoer because of maybe confidence in Marc-Andre Fleury in terms of letting that soft goal in and they lose in overtime? Like, for me, it was more of a, what's Pete DeBoer doing? Not, okay, he's Marc-Andre Fleury's playing bad and Robin Lehner is better, is not as good as him. Like, it doesn't make sense to me kind of how Robin Lehner came around to this conclusion. But hey, he says it like it is. And if you got motivation from it, it sure showed on the ice.
He went on to say I don't really care about what you guys say. Well, he does kind of care because he's using that as fuel for his game. He certainly did last night. So that was somewhat contradictory. But I think his point was this. The vast majority of people saw that Lehner came out of the starter's net yesterday after the morning skate and went, hold on a second. You're going away from Marc-Andre Fleury. This guy's up for a Vezina this year. This guy has been nails for you all playoffs, and you're going to make this move now? And so Lehner took that as a personal slight. It worked for him. I understand why people went down that road. DeBoer has done this before. We've seen him do it in last year's playoffs, and he's made no bones about the fact that we're going to use our entire team here. He was pretty measured in his comments after the game yesterday, where he said, our depth is our biggest advantage. He trotted out some numbers saying, I think we've played 18 times in the last 33 days. Basically, Marc-Andre Fleury's played as much as Andrei Vasilevskiy, and he's 10 years older. Like, at some point, that's going to catch up with you. Wouldn't admit to the fact that this was a plan coming in or anything like that, but basically, I'm giving my guy a little bit of a rest. And he said, Lehner has had a really tough gig here. He's had to play behind a legend. Well, when you call a guy a legend in your post-game clip and he didn't even play, that leaves the door open to me, Karen, that you're considering starting either guy in game number 5. There's a good case to be made that Lehner goes right back in after the performance he had yesterday. That stop on Cole Caulfield, that changes the game. Caulfield in alone, opportunity for the second time in as many games to score on a breakaway. I know that one's from a blue line in breakaway yesterday. Makes the nail save there, because if that goes to 2-0, Vegas isn't winning that game yesterday.
Nope. No, they're not. And I thought that was a turning point in the game. Like, he was beaten on one incredible shot. Paul Byron, he came in with speed on a breakaway after they successfully, Montreal, killed off a penalty. Nick Suzuki, right out of the box, finds Byron, gets the puck from his skate to his stick, comes in with speed, and does exactly what you want to do on a type of breakaway, which I don't understand why more players don't do that in a penalty shootout, Scott, but I digress on that one. Gets Lehner moving, he beats him. It was a perfect goal. Great. 27 of 28 saves, I believe. But, I mean, if you go back to Marc-Andre Fleury, 1.97 goals against average and a 9.21 save percentage in this playoffs. Like, he has been incredible. Maybe he was tired. And maybe Pete DeBoer asked him, like, how you feeling? He's like, you know what? Like, I'm not quite there. Like, this, I have played a ton in these playoffs. He's basically played almost every night except for the one day he got off in that 7-1 shelling that Leonard came in. And again, Pete DeBoer read the room on that one. He's like, we're a tired group. I'm not going to throw Fleury to the wolves against the rest of the team. I'm going to put Lehner in. Suck for Lehner at the time, but he stood in there, withstood the pressure, 7-1, and he comes back, and this is the performance that he has. Like, and Lehner's a DeBoer guy, right? Like, I think that's the reason they got him last year when DeBoer took over as head coach, and they brought him in. They signed him long term. Like, this is the guy that they want to take this franchise to the next step. It just happens that, oh, he did get hurt this season. Marc-Andre Fleury steps up and he played at an incredible Vezina level. So I don't think you can go wrong going to either goaltender.
He's got two great options. Who would you start if you were Pete DeBoer going into game five? Doug says you go with Fleury, you go with the goalie who brought you here. He probably needed a rest. Well, that was DeBoer's reasoning. And as I said, after the game, Doug, he left the door open to start either guy. I'm not sure there's a bad answer. Vegas needs answers in other areas of the ice. Now, we've had this text come in a bunch of different times. Yes, we're going to get to the officiating. It might be the biggest story, but it feels like the story we're hitting every single day. And there's some fatigue on my part. I don't know about your part, Karen. There's fatigue on my part for sure that this is the conversation we're having time and time again. Lee was also seventh person on the ice for Vegas. The number one topic of this series should be the Bush League refereeing. Completely biased. I think the chop to Corey Perry in OT Game 3, absolutely brutal. Furthermore, why is this a continuing theme at the professional level? Makes you wonder. All of that is fair. All of that is fair because how are you supposed to know? We brought this up with the Islanders and Tampa Bay series on Friday. And we brought up the interference call on Adam Pellick. Well, if you're going to call that, call it from the beginning of the game. And then last night, okay, you want to call Nick Suzuki, the chop on the hands, the hooking, whatever you want to call that, then call that all game. Don't just pick this one opportunity. There is literally an example of Thomas Nosek and Shea Weber going head-to-head in the game of daring Chris Lee to make a call. I'm going to hit you from behind into the boards. You going to call that? No? Cool. I'm going to cross-check him back. You going to call that? No.
Nope.
And then finally, they get to a point where they're wrestling out there and they're doing, okay, you know what, guys? We'll send both of you to the box.
That's roughing calls.
That's the standard. The one that's getting highlighted so much is at the end of the second period, the direct punch to the face by Braden McNabb of Nick Suzuki after the whistle. Chris Lee looking right at it and then turning his head away going, I'm
going to
pretend I didn't see that because I don't want to make a call here, do I?
I'm glad you saw that, Scott, because that's the first thing I thought of is like, me and my boyfriend watch it. We both laughed and like, Chris Lee literally turned his head just kind of wanting to ignore that play. Also, can we talk about the Bush League, the fact they let 2.3 seconds run off at the end of the second period? I don't know what they're doing out there. Scott, it seems to be, we're going to let things go and then it gets out of hand and it's like, and then we're going to call something to give someone a penalty. The Suzuki one was ridiculous. Yes, it's a penalty. It's a penalty in the regular season. It's not been called a penalty in the playoffs, you know? So like, why is that the standard you're putting out there? I don't know. I guess there's fatigue on my part. It's like, okay, another game, another bad officiating. This is just the way it is. I just don't think it's fair to the players.
What are we trying to peddle? I had that question on Friday. I'm left with the exact same question on Monday. What are we trying to sell here if you're the National Hockey League? Because this isn't just Chris Lee making a decision, I'm not going to call anything. You can't tell me that there isn't direction from the National Hockey League on what the standard is going to be. There is some. Hey, this is... And the consumers of this game, i.e., you in the listening audience, any of you who care about hockey, that's where you got to bang on the table and say, this isn't what we want here. And for maybe for some of you it is, but the amount of text that we see coming in anytime this comes up leads me to believe, Karen, that people want better than what we're seeing right now. They want a different standard. They don't want it to be just street rules out there. Anything goes, no blood, no foul. And you know what? Even if there is blood, Corey Perry's face, we don't care. I don't know how they missed that one. Like, you want to talk about determination? You want to talk about determination not to make a call? I don't know how it gets any bigger than that. Guys, somebody's going to have to bleed for us to call something. The man got sticked in the face and is bleeding all over the ice. No call.
I was on Twitter yesterday, probably throughout the game, Scott, like you probably were, just kind of to gauge the reaction, especially after the Shea Weber Tomic Gnosis situation, and then the Nick Suzuki, and then the punch to the face that he took at the end of the period. Anyways, like these are some of the tweets that we got, and these are from verified hockey accounts, Scott. Like, this league should be completely embarrassed with officiating in the series. It's been atrocious on both sides. The refs have really let this game get out of hand. Letting players dictate the game is one thing, but when the players don't know the standard, it's brutal. Hitting critical mass here in what kind of hockey we want in the playoffs. Refs have lost the plot entirely, and the players simply doing whatever they want. Carl Osler was on with the 6:50 morning show today, and they talked to him about playoff hockey and about, do players just kind of have the understanding, like we as fans do, Scott, and broadcasters, that yes, okay, just certain things are not going to be called in the playoffs. He says yes, and he's like, I understand that officiating is a hard job. I'm not going to always criticize the officials, and play gets a little tougher in the playoffs. Like, you know, you're playing for your teammates, you're going to be doing everything you can to finish a hit, but you're also going to know that things get, you know, if you do take a penalty, then it could be very catastrophic for your team in terms of the situation. But he did say, like, you have to know what the standard is. The players have to know. And last night, it was anything goes until we finally pushed the envelope, but they didn't even push. Like, once they finally did push the envelope, they still didn't call it. Like, I just don't understand.
This text comes in, if they call 10 power plays per team per game, people would be livid. I don't know what the happy medium would be, says this texter. I agree with that. However, if you were more determined to set the standard that we're actually going to call things that are penalties, penalties, players would adapt. And that's what we're talking about. Right now, players are adapting on the other side of it. Dude, they're not going to call anything. Do whatever you want out here. Punch a guy in the face after the whistle, run a guy into the end boards, cross-check him because they didn't call anything, so I guess they're not going to call that either. They're adapting in that manner now. If you, from the outset of the series, from the outset of the playoffs, called things more tightly, players would adapt. I fully believe that. They're not so conditioned to think, oh, you know what, guys? I watched the playoffs 10 years ago, or I watched the playoffs last year, and you didn't call that, so you can't call it now. What's the standard you're trying to set?
Well, and that's the thing. We always hear, call the rule book. And I understand that. But if you called the rule book to the T, Scott, there'd be 100 whistles a game. Like, it would just be excessively the other way. So it is a judgment call. But the point is that you're letting all this stuff go. It's basically jailhouse rules, beer hockey rules, whatever you want to let go. And then it's the penalties they do make. It's the Nick Suzuki's. Or the fact you're missing a penalty, and I guess it's because it was an overtime, I don't know, but a guy's literally leaking from his face in an obvious call. If you want to see how badly the penalty was missed, go back and look at the stitches and the scab on his face yesterday. Like, it's pretty obvious, got a high stick, and if a guy's leaking and you don't call that, like, that is all that these players want and us as fans want, I think. No, I don't want 10 penalties a game. But I do want consistency. And if you're going to let a bunch of things go early on in the game and then call something like that slash on Suzuki, I mean, come on. That's just, it's not what we want in the NHL, and it makes the referees look bad.
John in Vancouver says, no calls is exactly what I want unless it directly stops a scoring chance. It's part of the reason playoff hockey is so much better. You can't have it both ways. That's your opinion, John. I want to see more. I want to see special teams. You may not want the entire affair to be a special teams affair, special teams contest. It's still a part of the game. Like, in some ways, they're eliminating that part of it and saying, 5-on-5 is the only thing we want here. You change the game by not making calls as well. We'll continue to get into this an hour from now. David Amber is going to join us. We'll get his opinion. This shouldn't be the overriding sentiment when you are down to your final four teams and you are two wins away for any of those teams from getting to the Stanley Cup final, and this is an ongoing conversation every single day. That's not where we should be beginning. We didn't start there because of fatigue, but I agree with those who said, yeah, that's probably the biggest story coming out of this weekend. We didn't even get to the incredible save that Ryan Pulock made. We'll talk about that in the second hour with David Amber as well. We all like an underdog story, Karen, but that, can there be too much of what we consider a good thing? We'll explain next. Donovan Bennett will join us here on Rintoul and Sermon.
You're listening to Rintoul and Sermon.
This one comes in from Rob in Airdrie. Hi, guys. It's Rintoul and Sermon, by the way. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. Hope you're off to a great start. We're going to make it better. Rob in Airdrie says, Karen, I used to referee pro soccer and have several friends who still do it at the highest levels in the world. The governing body decides what the standard for refereeing is in a tournament or a league. Referees do what they're told, or they won't get games anymore. NHL is exactly the same. That's what they want.
Well, and I hear the call for Chris Lee and is it Dan O'Rourke, Scott, who have called the last two games to not call any more games in these playoffs. Chris Lee also called, I believe, game two of that Tampa Islanders. I think that was the Braden Point game, of course, with that goalie interference and then the 7 men on the ice when Tampa scored. But hey, it's all about consistency. And this one comes in 650-650-960-960. Send your text our way. Let us know what you think, because dirty hits, slashing, hitting, head hitting, interference, pick pit plays, those are the ones that need to be called on the ice. And I agree. Like, but if you look at that Shea Weber Tom McNoshek situation, how many penalties could you have called, Scott? I mean, Shea Weber cross-checked him in the neck, then cross-checked him in the numbers, and then Noshek comes around and gives him a punch in the face. Like, it's one of those things where if you're not going to call the obvious ones, that can be dangerous. Like, no offense to, like, Shea Weber literally cross-checked him right in the kidneys. Like, that could have been pretty dangerous, right? Obviously, it wasn't. Maybe it looked a little bit rougher on the screen than it did in actual physicality of it, but it did look like it was a kidney shot. And it's like, at what point in the situation, like, does someone really have to get hurt before something's called in terms of bad plays?
Or even if they are, in Corey Perry's case, it may not matter. And I don't blame Weber, because his reaction is, if you're not going to call the hit from behind into the boards, then I'm going to take my pound of flesh here. Because chances are you're not going to call that either. And he was validated in having that reaction by not being taken to the box for that infraction. And there are a couple more coming in Victoria among them. Exactly. These players are so skilled they can react appropriately. There wouldn't be 100 whistles a game. From minor to the NHL, same rules apply. Teams will adapt. They're adapting in one regard right now. Is that the regard we actually want to have them adapt in? That's what it comes down to. Right now, the league is sending a mandate that, yep, this is what we want here. And I agree with Rob and Airdrie saying, like, part of the reason the officials who are officiating games right now are getting those calls is because, and I mean the call to officiate, not the calls within the game, is because the NHL knows that these are people who are going to call it the way that they've asked them to call it. Here you go. This is what we want you to do. Follow the mandate. You do that. Don't worry about the noise. We'll deal with that. We'll figure it out. It's Rintoul and Sermon. We will continue to talk hockey throughout the course of this program. I want to get into what was a wild weekend in hoops. Donovan Bennett's going to join us here momentarily. Karen, if I told you, prior to seeing all of the basketball that's happened in the first couple of rounds, and now into the third round as the Western Conference Final got going yesterday, what would your reaction be to a Final Four that consists of Milwaukee, Atlanta, Phoenix, and the LA Clippers?
Meh. Really? Except for the fact, like, I'm a huge basketball fan, and I am intrigued by it. But honestly, in terms of just these four teams, there's no sexy team in there. These matchups are, there's no, I guess there's the history against Chris Paul playing the Clippers, but Chris Paul isn't even playing right now because he's in COVID protocol, so you don't have that. I guess there's some intrigue in how far can this Atlanta team go? Are they still playing with house money? Can Giannis get his team? I mean, there are, if you want to search deep for playoff storylines. Clippers, can Kawhi Leonard get a third team to an NBA title? Well, Kawhi Leonard's not playing, and I have a feeling he's probably not going to play for the rest of the playoffs in terms of what he's dealing with in an ACL injury. It's just, it's disappointing from the storylines, yet you could probably talk yourself into some intrigue.
Of course you can. Of course you can, because you still got stars to sell. Are they the stars that the majority of fans want you to be selling right now? Maybe not. We got a great Game 7 on Saturday. We had a controversial end to Game 7 yesterday. And on the heels of that, Donovan Bennett joins us now to talk some hoops and many other things, as he does every single Monday. Donovan, thank you very much for doing this, man. Happy Father's Day, belated it may be, but I hope you had a great one this weekend.
I did. It was, I mean, as good as Father's Day in a pandemic to be, just chilling at home with the family, thankful that we're all healthy, and binging some Netflix. and speaking of which, I'm doing my best Lewis Hamilton Drive to Survive F1 impersonation. I'm in the car right now, so if you hear sirens, it's because I'm speeding home to do a Tim and Sid interview or Tim and Friends interview later. But my apologies if you can't hear me correctly, or if you hear me speaking to a police officer at some point.
Well, I hope that's not the case, and I hope it's not quite Drive to Survive. The audio is coming through loud and clear right now, so thank you very much for taking the time. What is your reaction to a Final Four in the NBA that consists of Milwaukee, Atlanta, Phoenix, and the LA Clippers?
It's a disaster for Adam Silver and the people in Secaucus, New Jersey, and Park Avenue at the league head offices. I think the basketball will be great. Some fun matchups. I love the fact that we're going to usher in a new class of champions. Whoever wins, this is going to be Giannis's first ring, or this is going to be Paul George's first ring, or Devin Booker and Chris Paul's, or Trae Young so early in his career. Remember when we thought that drafting Trae Young was crazy because of Luka? Well, Trae Young might end up hosting the Larry O'B in his house in Atlanta. So I love the intrigue. I love the matchups. I love the styles mix fight aspect of it, to use some boxing terminology, in the NBA. But in terms of a commercial product for the NBA, it's a bit of a disaster.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think I saw the tweet that Adam Silver's probably running off a cliff in terms of the numbers that he's not going to get because no Brooklyn in the NBA or the NBA Eastern Conference Final against Philly. Let's take a look at that Atlanta-Philly Game 7 yesterday. Of course, Atlanta comes out on top. Is Atlanta the Miami Heat of last year?
Oh, wow. That's very interesting. I love that comp. I mean, after they made a coaching change, I suppose they are. Once they put Nate McMillan at the helm, and their schedule got soft and that coaching change was made at a specific point for that reason. They also got healthy, which is the most important thing. I mean, when you look at Travis Schlenk, the person who made that decision, the GM, he came from Golden State. And no, I don't think they're going to win a championship this year, but I think they're early Golden State in terms of Steph Curry went to the playoffs a couple times. He really pushed the Clippers and the Spurs, gave you some big playoff moments. They were building internally. And then the year after, they really took off, and they were a phenomenon. And they had this college atmosphere around them. And I think this team is somewhat similar. They got rappers with them in the locker room. They're dancing and putting videos on IG. And so I don't know if they're the Heat of last year, which was built for the bubble, but I see them being, you know, early days Golden State, where they really improved with internal improvement. No one thought Collins would be this good at this point in his career. No one thought Herder was going to be this good 2 months ago, 3 months ago. And so they've added some veterans like Gallinari, like Lou Williams, to supplement what they've done in developing their young players, and obviously they've got a star in Trae Young who's getting better by the game. So I don't know about the Heat, but I do think there's a comp, and it's in the other conference.
Trae Young and Luka Doncic will be forever linked together. It's just a matter of fact. And fair or not fair, Luka's got the verbiage we use around him. Generational player. Like, we know the talent. He's never got his team, though, out of the first round of the playoffs. Trae Young, though, he's arrived in this playoffs and showing what complete player he is, hasn't he?
I think so. And it's funny, we make the comp to Trae Young and Luka all the time, but we forget DeAndre Ayton was in that draft and went before both of them. And I would take either of them of Ayton. Ayton's played really well in the playoffs, don't get me wrong, and is probably the key for the Suns to advance past the Clippers. But a lot of what Ayton does is put on a plate for him by Devin Booker or Chris Paul. Trae Young and Luka, but really let's focus on Trae because he's still playing. He is creating for others. He is setting other people up and making them better, if not with his passes, then alone with his gravity. The fact that he's drawing defenders so far away from the three-point line, never mind the paint. The other thing that he's doing is he's owning the moment. He is living his best life in a way that many people compared him to Steph Curry when he came out, terms of his enthusiasm and his love to play the game. But I think the better comp is Reggie Miller going into hostile buildings on the road, having no care in the world of whether or not you're supposed to win or whether or not the franchise that you're representing has a winning history. He's saying, allow me to be the villain. I'm going to take all of that smoke. Everyone else can just concentrate on playing basketball. And so the play of Trae Young has really, really impressed me. But the audacity in his leadership has impressed me as well. So I think we need to give Trae Young his flowers. He has definitely earned his right in terms of being a top draft pick in a very, very talented draft.
In conversation with Donovan Bennett this morning on Rintoul and Sermon, let's talk about Ben Simmons because everybody else is, and he's taking most of the heat, even though it shouldn't all be on him, at least in my view. There's other problems in Philly. It's not just Ben Simmons. Fact of the matter is he took 3 fourth-quarter shots in this entire series, which is wild when you consider what he means to that team, whether it's offensively or not. Donovan, does he need to get out of Philly just for his career to have a better chance of being successful, or can he do it there?
He needs to get out of his head. I mean, you mentioned 3 fourth-quarter shots. Shots is a somewhat forgiving term. First of all, they were early in the series, in the first couple games. In the back end of the series, he wasn't shooting at all. And even those shots, we're talking about alley-oop dunk at the rim. We're not talking about him taking a proper set shot, something that he doesn't even look to do. And yes, I hear the stories about it. He does so many other things. He was an all-star player for a reason. His rebounding, his defense, his passing. Imagine how good he'd be at those other things if he was a threat to shoot, to even look to shoot. And so you don't have to be a prolific scorer to have an impact on the game as a point guard. Just look at Jason Kidd. Just look at Rajon Rondo. But guys who, when they had to shoot, they would take and make timely shots. And I think the real struggle for me with Ben Simmons in Philadelphia is this conversation is not one that we've had for the last couple of days or couple of weeks. We've had it for the last couple of years, specifically if you paid attention to what's happened in that market and how they've grown dissatisfied. They could have traded Ben Simmons, let's not forget, for James Harden or Kyle Lowry, and they chose not to. So they literally have put all their chips in the middle of the table and bet on him, but they haven't held him accountable to get better every summer at a skill that really has gone worse since he entered the draft and left LSU and came to the NBA. So either their inability to internally develop him or their inability to hold him accountable is a problem in Philly. Would a new lease on life and going somewhere else change that scenario? Possibly, but I think the biggest change has to happen with Ben Simmons. He has to want to be a player who earns the max contract that he has. And again, not taking shots in clutch situations, being on the bench for the most important moments for your team, that's not what a max player does.
And Donovan, I thought it was so telling, and Greg Anthony pointed it out in terms of when he didn't decide to dunk, a wide open dunk from the block, because you have to think in his head, well, if I by chance get fouled, I have to go to the free throw line. And it's in his head that he doesn't want to shoot free throws even, that he's giving up a wide open shot possible for an and one, and gives it to Thibault, who then gets fouled and, of course, goes 1-for-2 from the free throw line. But even Shaq was calling him out in the post game, and we all know how terrible Shaq is in terms of free throw shooting throughout his career. I just think, to me, it's like you said, it's just too much in his head, and I don't even know what his trade value is at this point, because it's probably taken a huge tank, and that's a huge amount of money that he's being offered or he's got on his contract for the rest of his rest of this deal. So I don't even know what Daryl Morey could get for a Ben Simmons.
It's a great question. It's fascinating. I don't know what Daryl Morey could get for him either. And you mentioned that play that was somewhat telling. And the help defender that was coming that maybe would have spooked Ben Simmons was Trae Young. And if you are his size, you're thinking, I want to take Trae Young and put him in the basket with the ball. I'm going to get an and one. And so even if I miss the free throw, I've gotten 2 points. And I want to send a message to the star player of the other team that I'm the impact player in this series on this team. Remember the conversation about whose team was it? Joel Embiid or Ben Simmons? That's not a conversation anymore. Tobias Harris is making a bigger impact at this point than Ben Simmons. And so I think one of the conversations that has to be had, and whether it's Philly or whether it's another organization, is Ben Simmons a point guard? Because if Ben Simmons was just a 3-and-D wing player, then some of these issues wouldn't be as egregious as they are. If he was a glorified version of Sean Marion, then you'd live with it. But when you're asking him to be Magic Johnson or LeBron James, then it's a different calculation.
It certainly is. A lot of people seeing if there might be a trade between the Trailblazers and the Sixers. That's been rumored for quite some time. They're sick of C.J. McCollum somewhat in that fan base, and the things he doesn't do particularly well, Ben Simmons does, vice versa. Who knows? Maybe that's the basis for a deal. Donovan Bennett with us for a few more minutes. We haven't touched on what was a great Game 7 between the Bucks and the Brooklyn Nets, and it didn't end the way star power suggests it should, with all due respect to Giannis. Kevin Durant's a bigger star. James Harden's a bigger star. And maybe Kyrie Irving comes back if they win that game. Not to be. Was there a great failing here on the part of the Brooklyn Nets, something you point to and say, what went wrong here? Or is it just one of those, sometimes there's a great game, someone has to lose, and it was your turn?
I think the great failing, and it's easy to say because it didn't work, but the great failing was to think that they could, in a way, I suppose, be the Toronto Maple Leafs of the NBA and just have all of their cap in one area and star players who are stars at putting the ball in the basket but aren't necessarily stars in defending it. Because when you do make that calculation, and listen, there's a lot of teams that would line up, have Kyrie Irving, James Harden, and Kevin Durant. And a lot of people were complaining that it wasn't fair and that the championship going back to Brooklyn was inevitable. But the problem with that calculus is if you're putting all of that investment, both in shots and in financial capital, in three guys, if one of them isn't around, or potentially one isn't around and the other isn't healthy, then where are you? And so I think that was always going to be the question with the Nets. Yes, if everyone is clicking and everyone is there, they're going to be able to outscore you. But if they can no longer outscore you for whatever reason, would they be able to continually get stops? And the answer was no. And listen, we are half a shoe size away from talking about Kevin Durant being maybe the greatest player on the planet Earth and the Nets going on to the first round. So they were really, really close. But the margins at high-level sport are really, really close. And it was a massive gamble and risk to put all of their chips in the table with three players who all have injury history and all, sadly, have broken down at later stages in the playoffs. James Harden has done it multiple times and been the hamstring multiple times. Kyrie Irving has had knee issues late in postseason multiple times. And Kevin Durant certainly finished healthy and finished really strong. But, you know, the last time we saw him in the postseason, it was him being helped off the court. So they're probably going to run it back because you can't say no to that star power, but it is always going to be a massive risk and a massive gamble when virtually your entire cap rests on the shoulders of three superstars with health issues and who haven't shown a propensity to get defensive stops for two of the three.
Game one of the Western Conference Final yesterday, Clippers coming in off that big win against Utah to punch their ticket for the first time to the Western Conference Final, but it was Devin Booker that stole the show for the Suns. 40-point triple-double. When I watch him, Donovan, what impresses me the most, yes, he can shoot the three, we know that. Yes, he can get to the hoop whenever he wants, but his willingness to just take what the defense gives him and his willingness to pull up for that mid-range game, what impresses you or stands out to you when you watch Devin Booker play?
Everything seems so easy. He's never in a rush. He's barely looks like he's perspiring, to be honest. No real change on his full expression. He gets to his spot under control, and he has an array of shots that he can utilize. Maybe that's why he doesn't seem stressed. He's got more tools in his toolbox, quite frankly. He's the golfer who's got the shot for every situation, every distance, every club. And he's a great three-point shooter. He's won a three-point contest. But he doesn't even rely on it as much as I think he can. He only took 7 three-point shots, which is close to a high. He's not like a Steph Curry or Trae Young, where he's in double digits and three-point shots attempted every single night. So if we're making comparisons, his game reminds me a little bit of Kobe. Gets to the mid-range, uses his triple threat, uses his pivot foot accurately. And then when he needs to, he can get the cup and still has enough bounce to finish. And what we saw in game one was a little bit of a throwback of Devin Booker, where he's got a little bit more ball in his hands. He uses a bit more playmaker for others because he wasn't playing with the dominant point guard. It was more Devin Booker that we saw with rookie Rubio as a teammate when the score is good. Early in his career, the difference is his teammates are much better. so we can see the true fruits of his labor. Man, he is just a treat to watch offensively.
Yeah, he certainly is, and maybe this is the beginning for young stars consistently moving in the playoffs the way that Trae Young and Devin Booker have to this point in time. Donovan, before we finish this conversation today, I wanted to talk about National Indigenous Peoples Day. It's an important day in our country for awareness. I believe it's an educational opportunity, a learning opportunity as well. There's a lot of ignorance about our National Indigenous Peoples and about some of the things in this country right now that people should be outraged about. We talk about sports outrage. There are things like clean drinking water in so many communities that hasn't happened. That's what people should be outraged about. One of the things I believe mentally is a barrier for a lot of people out there is, well, where do I start? I don't know much. Where do I begin? What is a gateway into this conversation for a lot of our listeners, in your opinion?
That's a great question. I mean, I think the first thing you can do is you can donate. You don't have to understand to be able to support. So whether it's the residential school survivors or other charities that support the Indigenous community, Becky Scott, famous decorated Olympian for our country, started, Spirit North, which is a philanthropic endeavor to make sure that our Indigenous communities have the mental and physical wellness that they need, and they engage the community through sports and outdoor activities and really nurturing the land that we have. So I think one thing is finding different resources, different references. The other is reaching out to, your Indigenous brothers and sisters, whether it's in your place of work or in your community, and having those conversations and, allowing them to have a safe space to have a conversation with you so that you're an ally and so that you understand some of their issues so that you can pick up the speaker box or the platform, whatever it is that you have, and speak on behalf so that they don't always have to be the one beating the drum on some of the issues. And you mentioned, one of them that I think a lot of people don't really understand because it's unfathomable in our country, and that is the fact that there are many communities in our country that don't have clean drinking water, that have been asking for it for a long time. And all of the people who look in those communities, they don't look like me and you. They are the first inhabitants of our land. Man, I don't know about you guys, but I know in my community, if the power is out for more than an hour, it's trending on Twitter, and people are upset. So imagine the fact that there are people without running water that's clean to drink. And I sometimes sit and I think we're watching these playoffs, so we're watching Terry Price, and goaltender with Indigenous heritage, stand on his head for quote-unquote Canada's team, the Canadians. And I just imagine what it'd be like watching one of those communities and supposed to be feeling part of this country. And I'm watching players on the bench spray themselves with water. They have so much abundance of it, and yet I can't open up the taps and have something to drink. So we really, as Canadians, if we do want to put our entire country first, we have to think about some of the ills, not just past, but still present day, that are implicated on these communities. And people want to talk about residential schools as if they were the past tense and how scary and how hurtful that is. Well, in our present day system, there are more Indigenous kids in foster care now than in the history of our country. More Indigenous kids in foster care than any other part of our community in terms of ethnic background. So, yeah, we have a lot of work to do, and it starts by being willing to have the conversation. And so I thank you guys for having it.
Well, thank you very much for your eloquent words, as always, Donovan. And there are some great resources out there. I know you've pointed people to a lot of them on social media. We will try to do the same and amplify those voices as well. Have a great day. I hope your interview goes well. I'm glad we didn't hear sirens. Thank you very much for your time once again.
No, this was a successful drive. I got home, got the checkered flag, had a great talk with you guys, and I don't have a speeding ticket. So box, I've made it in safely.
Well done. Thank you, Donovan.
Thanks, Donovan.
That's Donovan Bennett. Joins us here every single Monday. And there are a lot of different places to start. I do believe that's part of it, Karen. A lot of people don't want to... They don't want to on sports radio hear what they consider political conversation. But there are so many different gateways into this conversation on National Indigenous Peoples Day. We don't have to go very far back with Ethan Bear. We're talking two rounds ago in the playoffs when Ethan Bear was threatened and had racial abuse hurled upon him for a mistake on the ice. That's just one story. And if, as a sports fan, that's your gateway into better understanding and opening your eyes a little bit and learning more, that's something to me on National Indigenous Peoples Day. It's a small step forward, but as Donovan said, there's a lot of different ways to support.
You know, I've been doing a lot of reading, Scott, lately too, because it's just, we're not taught a lot of this in school either about our nation's history and the dark side of our nation's history, right? Like, we don't, like, we hear a lot about, you know, the dark side of the United States, but there's so much up here that we just don't know about. So I've been doing a ton of stuff just trying to, you know, educate myself on the history and then what's going on right now, because my mother and my brother both traveled to northern small indigenous communities to do work. My brother builds houses and then my mother does some work with educational purposes for underprivileged communities. And it's, so I've been trying to better myself by reading more and learning more about, you know, the atrocities that have gone on in our country and about what's going on right now. So good for Donovan. He always speaks very eloquently about this situation, this kind of stuff. And yes, if the more we learn, the better we are.
Absolutely. And I was thrilled to hear over the weekend that there's a number of employers across this country that said, you know what? Monday's going to be a holiday. We're going to pay our full staff. We're going to close our business, and you can do what you want, but we would encourage you as part of our staff to educate yourself further, to get some resources. It's a conversation that needs to continue. It's Scott Rintoul, it's Karen Sermon with you on this Monday. There's a bunch of stuff we haven't even talked about. If you are a believer in karma, then maybe you were happy with what you saw yesterday afternoon. We'll explain next right here on Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
We got a ton of texts coming in regarding NHL officiating. I'm not surprised by it. We will get to your texts throughout the course of this show. We brought it up. It was one of the big stories of the weekend. For a lot of you, it's the biggest story of the NHL playoffs. That's a problem. Quite frankly, that's a problem. When you're down to your final four teams and you're supposed to be promoting your product at the best time of year and the hardest trophy to win, the fact that the officials continue to take center stage is a problem for your sport.
It is a problem for your sports, Scott. We should be talking about, you know, goalie controversies in Vegas. Who do they start in Game 5, Robin Lehner or Marc-Andre Fleury? We should talk about Ryan Pulock and his incredible save to keep pull even for the New York Islanders as Tampa was looking to come back and force overtime against the Islanders. Did you think they were going to score? I thought they were going to tie it up.
What a move by McDonough. Out of nowhere, right? That puck comes cross ice, time's winding down. He's got to fire that puck, right? And he makes the spin move, backhand, yawning cage. Oh, wait, Ryan Pulock has dived into the crease and made a game saver, quite literally. It was fantastic.
It was. Semyon Varlamov was well out of position. He thought he had the wide open net. And Pulock was the one who actually turned the puck over to Kucherov, who then found Ryan McDonagh. And I also was impressed, too, because my first thought was, well, good thing he didn't close his hand over the puck in the crease, because that looks like something he could do. But instead, he shovels it to the corner. That series is tied 2-2, going back to Tampa Bay, Game 5 tonight. Of course, we have David Amber coming up at 10:30. We will talk more hockey. But yeah, it's a problem, Scott, when once again, it's just talking about the lack of consistency with NHL officiating. It's your final four teams. These are supposed to be your best team's product on the ice. And night after night, well, the officiating product has not been the best on the ice.
And if you didn't want to watch that this weekend, if you want to turn your head away and say, I can't watch this anymore. I think most of our consumers were watching hockey at some point, whether they complained about it or not. We'll get into more of it with David Amber at the bottom of this hour. You were probably watching some golf yesterday, and you watched a U.S. Open decided in a way it just hasn't been decided before, with the winner going birdie-birdie on the final two holes of the tournament to win it outright. And let's be clear about this. John Rahm went out and grabbed that trophy, and he deserves credit for doing so. And Karen, I'm really glad he finished birdie-birdie so that we're talking about that as opposed to all of the chaos that unfolded around him on the leaderboard. We had all of these big names. We had a Canadian story we were invested in going into the final round. And one by one, they continued to fall, and they couldn't clutch up. I'm glad Rahm did that so that it's not, well, it's just the guy who survived the best as opposed to a guy who needed to go out, post a score, and get it like he did.
The U.S. Open, the golfers yesterday, Scott. We said how the U.S. Open likes to test you to par. Well, it did that, especially on the back nine, for a bunch of golfers that are best in the game, like Rory McIlroy, Colin Morikawa, and he's young, I understand that, but he's won a PGA Championship. Bryson DeChambeau, Brooks Koepka, who was out there earlier. Like, at one point, we're looking at maybe do Bryson and Brooks have a chance of having the playoffs? I know Brooks was very far ahead at that point, but in terms of on the course, but still, that was a conversation. Or six guys in a playoffs. Like, that's how close we were at one point. Bryson DeChambeau had the lead at the turn, a one-shot lead. He almost got a hole-in-one on the eighth hole, and everyone was hitting shots on the course at this point. Like, you were just seeing fantastic shot after shot, and all of a sudden, the U.S. Open got these guys. A switch was flipped, and nobody could do anything except one player, and that's the guy who walked away with the trophy.
Well, and it's funny, because while that was happening, Jon Rahm, I guess it was a little bit after what you're describing with DeChambeau. He's only a little ahead of DeChambeau on the course. Jon Rahm had those birdie putts, and he couldn't quite make them. And he went,
Nope. Geez,
he's going to look back on these opportunities and putting himself in position, and you could see that he was sweating it a little bit, and then he does the exact opposite on 17 and 18. Not easy putts at all, and he found a way to roll them in. But those other players, you mentioned they were making shots early. I suppose the only one who wasn't was Mackenzie Hughes.
Yeah.
I was draping myself in the national flag heading into the final round. All right, let's go get this Mackenzie Hughes. And he just had a tough one. He didn't play well. He started poorly. Thought he might get it together on the tail end of the front nine. And then, I mean, we all know what typified the round. The ball getting stuck in the tree typified the round for him, didn't it?
The ball getting stuck in the tree, but after it bounced off the cart path and could have gone any direction, Scott. It could have gone left, right, forward, back. Instead, it goes back directly up and gets lodged in a tree. It's an unplayable ball, and he had to take a double bogey there, I think. It's where his round turned. He did a good job of, you know, he started off rough. He got a couple of birdies, got it back to even par, I believe, on that front nine, and that's just where it all turned. It was just, I felt bad for him. It seemed like the pressure of the moment did get to him. Russell Henley as well, who was tied for the lead going into the final round. It just seemed like for those two guys, it was just too big of a situation. Hey, it's a learning experience for Mackenzie Hughes. He will learn from that down the road, but it was tough to watch. What wasn't tough to watch, or maybe it was for some, or maybe it was people, Scott, I don't know about you, but it's like, yeah, I've had a back nine like that on the golf course before. Bryson DeChambeau, what the hell happened?
A quad. Like,
it was incredible. But before even the quad, he had bogey, bogey, double bogey, and then he gets two pars, and then he double bogeys, 16 or 17? He goes into the canyon. Then he goes into a sand trap. Then he goes across the hole. Oh, and at one point, he actually hit a ball almost into a empty Stella case on the course. Like,
landed
it was just
right beside.
One miss.
good free advertising for Stella Artois there.
Also, like, why is there a case of Stella? Do people just carry like six packs around on the U.S. Open? That was my question about it. I don't know. But still, it was funny because it's kind of like, okay, for those who golf, it's like, yeah, we've all had a back nine like that. Except
Yep. It's
not, you know, chance to win a major at the U.S. Open.
And we're talking about a guy who is the reigning U.S. Open champ.
Yes.
And has moved his way up the leaderboard to that point, and he comes unglued at the end. Brooks Koepka, I think that was part of the story. You mentioned that it looked like those two players might be destined to meet somehow, some way in a playoffs. There's a guy who knows how to close, and he couldn't quite close yesterday. Ends up being a decent finish in terms of the leaderboard, but it's not what we're used to. Rory McIlroy, you mentioned. Louis Oosthuizen, did you feel badly for him? He's well-regarded on the tour. It did look like mm-hmm. it was his tournament to lose. And in some ways, he kind of lost it on 17. He has the errant tee shot there. The holes leading up to that, he was scrambling a little bit, but he was finding a way to at least keep himself right up at the top of that leaderboard before Rahm snatched away the pole position. Felt like maybe we were destined for a playoff until that tee shot on 17.
You said it earlier, Rahm was always giving himself a birdie putt. Like, he was giving himself a birdie chance, and they weren't dropping until 17-18. Louis was playing decent golf, consistent golf, but it was basically a par chance at almost every opportunity, and he was getting them. He was saving them. And he just tried to go for it. I don't know if it was a mishit or I think he tried to make a draw, and it just didn't draw, and it went into the canyon, and he had to take that bogey at, and he had a chance for par at 17 still, but he got the bogey, and then on 18, he had a holdout from the fairway. Just didn't happen. Six runner-ups, career runner-ups at majors. He's back-to-back runner-ups this year, Scott. We always forget the story was Phil Mickelson, but he finished second to Phil Mickelson at the PGA Championship. He's playing some consistent golf. I will say this. I did want Rahm to win. Like, it's like Louis is a great story and he's playing some really good golf, but for me it's like I just want to see Rahm. Now the narrative around Rahm is not he still hasn't won a major. Now he's a major champion. Seeing him hold his little kid first Father's Day in America. His dad was there as well. I didn't realize. Like, he proposed to his wife on that golf course, eh?
And he did.
We all know that's where his first win came. He loves San Diego. I was really excited for him to take home that championship.
Well, and you saw how excited he was. The big fist pumps on 17 and 18. Yes. And he's out there practicing in case he's got to play some extra holes, doesn't have to. And afterwards, we all know the story. This is a guy who was leading the Memorial 6 shots better than everybody else, and he gets pulled from the tournament because of COVID, and now he gets cleared and he can play the U.S. Open. He certainly referenced that post-match yesterday.
He did. And, you know, he said all the right things, and he understands where the world is at and that at any point in time, this is kind of like Dominic Ducharme right now. Like, he's been vaccinated, but he said, you know what? Like, I understand. I followed all the rules. The PGA followed all the rules. I could have hung my head, but you know what? I stayed positive. Playing some good golf, ends up, gets pulled out of the tournament. Next tournament, wins the U.S. Open. Not too
well,
bad.
Well, let's get to what they're saying, and we'll hear him to lead it off. Here's what Jon Rahm had to say afterwards and everything that's gone on with him this month from the Memorial to now.
I'm a big believer in karma, and after what happened a couple weeks ago, I stayed really positive, knowing big things were coming. I didn't know what was going to be, but I knew we're coming to a special place. I know I got my breakthrough win here, and it's a very special place for my family. And the fact that my parents were able to come, I got out of COVID protocol early, I just felt like the stars were aligning, and I knew my best golf was to come.
We highlighted his comments on this show a week ago because we hadn't heard from Jon Rahm. And what did he say? Everybody's going after the PGA, said there should have been an exception. No, there shouldn't have. They did things the right way. It sucks. I didn't want to be the test case for that. But they did things the right way. No, I shouldn't have played alone. No, they shouldn't have changed the rules. We all knew what the rules were. They needed to follow this. There are bigger things in life. I had a lot of time for the way he handled that. And the karma aspect of this certainly entered my mind, and obviously his as well.
He's grown up a lot, hasn't he? When he first came on the tour, Scott, he was a... he had some fire, and he still does. We see it, but we see it more in a positive way. Like, he was someone who was very demonstrative on the course, you know, using some bad language. If he had a bad shot, you just always knew where Jon Rahm stood in terms of his golf and how he felt about his golf at the time. Hearing him speak this week, you know, he's married, he's a father now for the first time. It just seems that he definitely has grown up in the last, 5 years that he's been on tour. I like him. I find him someone to root for. I find his honesty refreshing. I find his excitement on the course, it endears me to him, because you see it with Tiger, you know, after a big shot here or there, but you don't see those big massive fist pumps all that much. I love it. He understands the importance of the moment and how important certain shots are for him. So I think I've got a lot of time for Jon Rahm.
With all due respect to Jon Rahm, I wish those fist pumps would have been coming from Mackenzie Hughes yesterday. I would have loved to see the young Canadian go out and grab the U.S. Open, becoming the first Canadian to achieve that feat on the men's side. Here is Mackenzie Hughes after what was a very tough 77 way to close after being the 54-hole leader.
Yeah, it was weird. I felt like I played well out of the gate. I hit 2 great shots on one and hit just over the green into a really bad lie. And so kind of got off to not the best start and just 3 over through 6 and hadn't really hit many bad shots. And then kind of made a nice little comeback there. And, I mean, had a putt on 10 from 10 feet to get back to even for the day, 1 shot back. And, I mean, I was right in the tournament. And if not for a really unfortunate break on 11, who knows what might have happened. I don't know. I just feel like stuff like that means that probably wasn't meant to be for me. First time having a ball stuck in the tree. So, and then from there, I just kind of got in a rough, it was basically 5 holes that undid my whole tournament. Went 5 over in a 5 hole stretch or something like that. So can't be doing that. Back 9 of a major. And yeah, so here we are, and disappointed with the result. But I mean, overall, I feel like, I mean, I'm going to learn a ton from this and my game's going to be better for it, but it sucks right now.
Lowest round of the day on Saturday. Third round, gets himself in the final pairing for the U.S. Open. 5 missed cuts leading up to the U.S. Open. For Mackenzie Hughes, yes, this is a learning experience, Scott, but I think it's good to see where his game is after leading up into this, because it seems like he maybe has turned a corner in terms of making cuts and finding some more confidence in his game. So I do hope he takes away the positives from this more than the negatives of that final round.
There's two things I love here. One, in that interview, he's not crestfallen. He's disappointed. It sucks, but he's not crestfallen. Man, I'm never going to have this opportunity again. I can't believe I screwed this up. I liked the measured approach, despite the fact there's disappointment. What I liked even more was what I heard Saturday night. I caught his interview after the third round and the expectation for going into the final round with the 54-hole lead. And he said something to the effect of this: look, I don't know if I'm going to be great tomorrow or if I'm going to have a tough one tomorrow. But what I do know is I needed to put myself in this position to find out. And I've done that. I loved that. Hey, let's see how it goes out there. But this is an accomplishment in itself, because I'll never find out unless I play the 3 rounds I've played to get me to this point in time. I love the mindset. It gives me a lot of confidence in what lies ahead for him.
Yeah, absolutely. He went on the PGA Tour a few years ago, of course, in Kapalua out in Hawaii. I think he's had some pretty decent results since then, but lately, obviously not playing too well, Scott. Winning golf is hard. Rory McIlroy hasn't won a major since 2014, and we regard him as one of the top players in the world, expected to, you know, go on Tiger-like runs during his heyday. Jordan Spieth, we saw what happened with him. Like, it's not easy to win on the PGA Tour, so good for him getting himself in that position. I like where he is mentally. I like where his game is on the course as well.
Reggie Leach, remember those Flyers teams of the 70s, scored 61 one season, scored 50 in another, had a 45-goal campaign as well. One of those Flyers who's held in extremely high regard. Reggie Leach also is a part of our indigenous population. He is a member of the Ojibwe. Ojibwe, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, ethnicity. And Reggie Leach was on in Toronto this morning. This is a guy who won a cup, third overall pick in 1970 as well. Reggie Leach talked some hockey. He also talked about where we're at in this country with regards to recognition of our indigenous peoples and where things need to go to get better. Have a listen.
We, as myself as an elder, and our, this is all about our young kids growing up. This is all about kids that are being born and kids that are 5, 6, 7 to 16, and all our young kids, is that what are we teaching them? It's just going to be, all this is going to be a repeat thing year after year after year after year. And you know, we always say that, kids' life matter. But it's not only for First Nation people, it's for everybody in the whole world. We got to start looking after our kids and pointing them in the right direction and taught the right thing at a young age and move on from there. So those are the things that we have to really get control of. And then, like you just said, listening. That's the most important thing in life, is listening and learning. And, you know, when I speak to the kids, I talk to them, I says, you know, if you don't listen, you don't learn. Simple as that. So, and you hit it right on the spot where you just said, is that we have too many people that aren't listening.
Amen. And that starts with a willingness to listen. It's a really good interview. I encourage you to seek it out. Good conversation with Reggie Leach this morning with Leadoff on the Fan 590.
There is a library. I think I saw this on social media last week. I believe it's in Copenhagen, Scott. Instead of books, you can rent 30 minutes with another person where you sit there and have a conversation with them. It's somebody else of a different ethnicity, and you learn about their history and their background. Could you imagine just doing that, just learning from different people, their experiences growing up, different ethnicities around the world, what it was like? I think that's it's an incredible idea, and that's kind of what Reggie's talking about. We have to listen. We have to learn.
Yep. It begins with that willingness. Use those two ears and be willing to engage in the conversation instead of saying, things are fine. I'm good. We've outraged about a lot of different things, especially in the sports world. Maybe direct it to some places where it can affect some change in this country. It's Scott Rintoul. It's Karen Sermon. And there has been a new hire in Seattle. We'll tell you what it is next with the Kraken right after this.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
Seattle Kraken have made a hire. No, not that one yet. Not that one quite yet, Karen.
You had me, Scott. I thought you were going to announce Rick Tocchet, next head coach of the Seattle Kraken. No?
Might be him. Might be someone else. Elliot Friedman, over the last few days, has been putting that out there. It's been confirmed to him there's a third meeting, and so that would put Rick Tocchet as the leader in the clubhouse, perhaps. But they made their television analyst announcement today, and they did it the way they've been doing a bunch of these. They do social media reveals. Mm-hmm. John Forslund, great play-by-play voice. They hired him a while back, and that's kind of how they did the reveal of him on social media, with a phone call and a FaceTime. And that's what they did today, and they used Forslund, I should say, as the guy to set it up. And who did he get in contact with on FaceTime to announce that he's the new color analyst for the Seattle Kraken on television?
Little JT Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Former NHLer. He's also, though, Scott, I mean, he just played last season in Sweden, one season over there. 2011 to 2019, 7 years in the NHL with Tampa, Anaheim, and Minnesota. He is officially retiring from professional hockey and is going to take the color play-by-play television job along with John Forslund. So they're making another hire, I think another great hire by an organization that seems to be doing it right.
I agree. And JT Brown was part of that Tampa Bay Lightning team back in 2014-15 that went to the Stanley Cup Final, ultimately falling to the Chicago Blackhawks in that series. Todd Lywicki, I'm not suggesting that he's the driving influence behind this, but Lywicki was with the Tampa Bay Lightning at the time. There would have been at least a familiarity between the player at the time and the executive who is now running the ship down in Seattle as well. And like most things Seattle has done so far, didn't you see this when you and I caught wind of it this morning? Go, good hire. Like, well-spoken guy, recent NHLer, has been able to speak on a variety of topics, not the least of which has been racism, lack of awareness, lack of ethnicity in the sport. JT Brown, a lot of people will remember, is the player who stood on the bench and raised his fist years ago now. We're not talking about last summer when the conversation got much broader across the National Hockey. We're talking years ago now. I like the hire, and he's a very well-spoken person. I think it'll be a great addition to Seattle staff, and it continues to be, here's our mandate, here's what we're going to do, and we continue to do it. We will be the most diverse organization, not only in this league, but in their opinion, in North American sports.
Yes, absolutely. We've seen it, Scott, already when they hired Everett Fitzhugh. He became NHL's first black team broadcaster when he was hired as the Kraken's radio play-by-play announcer. This Seattle Kraken organization, yes, has said, we're going to set the standard and we're going to live by this and breathe it. And they're doing exactly that. I applaud them in many aspects. We've seen diversity in many different roles, Scott, not just on the television side. Of course, a lot of female representation as well inside their head office, analytics. We all know about that. So good on the Kraken. It is JT Brown is going to join the broadcast team.
And yet nobody's talking Seattle Kraken for the most part coming out of the weekend. And there are other stories in hockey that we should be getting to. You know, we didn't talk much about that game between the Islanders and the Tampa Bay Lightning. Islanders coming out of a second period up 3-0 kind of feels like, all right, you know what the result's going to be here. Hold on for a second, because Braden Point gets the Lightning on the board. They score another one, and all of a sudden there's 13 and a half minutes remaining in that third period. That place got quiet in a hurry, and that place doesn't get quiet very often.
No, that was a, uh-oh, what's going to happen? The defending Stanley Cup champs are coming. And honestly, like, even the Ryan McDonagh shot, but even before that, like, I really thought that Tampa was going to tie this thing up. I thought maybe, you know, when Victor Hedman takes a penalty under 2 minutes left in the game, that maybe that's when it was over, but they managed to get the puck. Pull the goalie, Andrei Vasilevskiy, and then, of course, we talked about the Ryan Pulock save with Semyon Varlamov well out of his net to keep it a 3-2 game. It just seemed like Tampa found their feet, and then when they start pushing and when they start firing, you're just like, okay, just wait for the Avalanche to keep coming, because that's exactly what's happening. A big win in terms of the series. It's not 3-1 now. I will say this, Tampa has still never lost 2 games in a row until you go back to that sweep by Columbus 2 years ago in the playoffs. So if you're a betting man, you'd probably bet on Tampa getting back to its winning ways, but fun series, though. Both of these series have been fun. I actually, Scott, had to go back and rewatch some highlights and read a story on the game today, because so much stuff happened on the weekend. Like, I forgot. I actually thought for a second, did Brooklyn win or Milwaukee win? I have to go back and figure this out, because just so much stuff is happening. And so I actually had to go back and rewatch this to be like, oh, yeah, that's what happened. The Pulock save.
Yeah, it was like the sports equivalent of the smorgasbord where you're just not quite sure where you should begin and how much can you fill your plate up, and then you almost forget what's at the table. David Amber joins us now to talk some NHL hockey. David, thank you very much for doing this. Hope you had a great Father's Day. How are you?
Good, good. Yeah, happy Father's Day to you, and nice to be with you guys.
Yeah, we're not starting where we should when it comes to hockey because our listeners have sent in text after text. We opened this show today, David, talking about goalie controversy, if there is one, isn't there? Robin Leonard's comments and overtime heroics and the Flurry gaffe. The second we brought up officiating, our text message inbox just started getting littered with text. This is not a good thing for the sport, is it?
No, I mean, it's not the narrative the NHL wants to be talking about right now. And, you know, it's kind of in the forefront. And I'm sure in your market, too, it's reminiscent. People are having flashbacks to 2011 when, you know, there was a lot of dissent against what was going on in the Vancouver-Boston Stanley Cup final and all the antics we saw from Marchand and a few of the other guys and how the Sedins were being treated really throughout the postseason. So sure, it's brought up some wounds in Vancouver. But yeah, you know, it's not the storyline. We want to be talking about, you know, Robin Leonard. We want to be talking about these great series that could be both staring down, you know, with game seven. They're into the best of three situations right now. So it's not the storyline that we want to be digging into, but it's sort of unavoidable based on, you know, a few factors. Obviously, the missed slash by Marchessault in game three that ultimately didn't prove costly. Montreal won that game. But then the same two officials, and I think this might have to do with COVID, the fact, the border situation, everything else, the exact same two officials, Chris Lee and Dan O'Rourke, had to go out there and officiate game four and, you know, kind of put them in a bad spot because there was already this sentiment that, man, these guys are making mistakes and there's some incompetency and everything else going on there. So it sort of started out a discussion that's continued on and people weren't happy with how, you know, yesterday's game was managed or some would say mismanaged by the officials. So that's where we're at, unfortunately. That's why I guess that's what we're talking about, right?
Yeah, unfortunately. And we will get to some of the other hockey stories as well. But when we get to this point of the playoffs, and it seems we get there every single year with this conversation, the pushback that comes from traditional hockey fans is we don't want to see 10 power plays a game for each team. That's not the type of hockey I want to see. My argument is players will adapt. They're adapting right now, aren't they, David? Because they're adapting to what some people are calling jailhouse rules, whatever you want to call it. They'll adapt on the other side. Why does this fear exist that if the officials enforce the rule book a little more strictly, that all it's going to be is power play after power play after power play?
Yeah, you know what? I don't even know if it's a matter of them having to be stricter. I think it's more a matter of it having to be consistent. And you know, you can't like last night, you can't watch Nick Suzuki get punched in the face in a scrum situation. You're standing 2 feet from that. You don't call anything. And 3 minutes later, you're calling a ticky-tack slash, you know, a ticky-tack hold. The players are going, well, wait a minute. A minute ago, it was okay to punch a guy in the face, and now it's not, and now I can't do anything. It's got to be consistent. No one wants to sit and watch power play after power play. I think that's a very fair and true statement. But I do at the same time think the players expect consistency. So they know where the standard is. They know where the bar is, where the line is that's been drawn, and to not step over that line. And if they step over that line, they understand there'll be consequences. I think that's the bigger issue, continuity, consistency. So players just aren't taken by surprise when certain things are getting called and certain things aren't, and fans for that matter.
Talk about being surprised. I don't know about you, David, but I sure was when I saw this in the morning the tweets coming out that Robin Lehner was in the starter's net for Vegas, and then we see that he started last night's game, looked very well, looked very good. I got beat on that one shot by Paul Byron. But what was your first reaction to it? Did you believe the Pete DeBoer, Marc-Andre Fleury needed some rest argument, or do you think there was a little bit of that gaffe in his decision, or the gaffe that Marc-Andre Fleury made leading to his decision?
Well, you know what, Karen, I was really surprised, I'll be honest with you. I just thought that, you know, Marc-Andre Fleury has done so much in his career and, quite frankly, has played very well through this postseason. I mean, he has a 1.97 goals against, a save percentage well above .900. Yes, he had some really over-the-top mistakes for an elite goaltender in the last few games. But I also thought the biggest issue surrounding Vegas was the lack of scoring. And quite frankly, it still is an issue. Yes, they won last night's game, but, you know, they barely had any scoring opportunities. They were able to find a way to win. When I look at, you know, games two and three, do I put that on Marc-Andre Fleury? No, I don't. I look at that as a lack of an inability to score. And if you want to go back to what Scott was talking about with the power plays, Vegas has had, I believe, 11 power plays now or 12 power plays. They haven't scored with the man advantage. I mean, that's what, to me, is the bigger concern surrounding Vegas. So when I saw Robin Leonard was getting the start, I looked at it as a bit of a panic move. I just thought, wow, Marc-Andre Fleury has done everything to give Vegas the ability to win these games. The fact that, you know, Alex Tuck could have had a hat trick in game three and just couldn't bury it on Carey Price, that's not on Fleury. And I know he had the egregious error there that tied the game with less than 2 minutes left. I'm not discounting that with Marc-Andre Fleury, but I did feel, you know, he's a battler. He's a guy who the team will play hard, you know, behind. He's a guy you want to have in those pressure situations, a three-time cup winner, a Vezina finalist. So I was surprised, but, you know, it obviously worked out. And now the interesting question is, will we see Marc-Andre Fleury start game five? And there's a lot of speculation that we'll, you know, that was about rest, and now he's rested, and now you can put a rested Marc-Andre Fleury in for game five. So maybe this will all be, you know, a method to the madness that, you know, Peter DeBoer has been to the Stanley Cup final a couple of times with different teams, so he knows a lot more about his goaltending situation than I ever will. But I'll be honest with you, I was definitely very surprised to see Robin Leonard start game four.
And I mean, I don't think you could probably go wrong with either of them, just based on the numbers you've thrown out. And we saw Pete DeBoer ride Robin Lehner last year in the bubble. They signed him this past offseason to that big deal. David, assuming that he's going to be the guy moving forward, it's just Marc-Andre Fleury took the starter's net this season and never really looked back when Robin Lehner was hurt. So I don't think there's any probably a wrong decision for Pete DeBoer going forward.
No, well, here's the thing. The other thing, you know, and I forgot to mention this, the other thing that sort of struck me wasn't just that Marc-Andre Fleury has played well enough for them to win, but it's that Robin Leonard was injured at the end of the year, and yesterday marked his second start in 41 days. It wasn't, you know, when you'd run out Marc-Andre Fleury for all those games, the one time you played Robin Leonard, your team got shelled 7-1, and listen, that wasn't really on Leonard. The whole team wasn't there for that game one versus Colorado. But I sort of said, wow, you're rolling the dice, in a sense, with a guy who's barely played in essentially 6 weeks. But, you know, again, Peter DeBoer has a better sense of his goaltending tandem, how tired they are, mentally, physically fatigued they might be, and the mood of his team. And maybe there was some sort of loss of confidence on some level with Marc-Andre Fleury, who's made a few uncharacteristic mistakes along the way during this postseason. I'm interested to see. I'm going to stop guessing, because when I guess wrong. So I'm really interested to see, and Peter DeBoer is not letting us know anything either. So he likes the mystery involved there. You know, he's holding his cards close to his chest, and it'll be interesting to see either way. As you said, there's two good options. I won't be surprised if we see Fleury, and quite frankly, I won't be surprised if we see Leonard, just knowing that he won the last game and the team obviously is confident behind him as well.
Will you be surprised if you see another COVID positive test, David? We've got a coach who's missing right now in Dominique Ducharme. General manager and Kelly McCrimmon as well. Those people are around the players on both teams. They're around the staffs. Personally, I'm just hoping we get COVID reports that come out each day that say nothing to report here.
Yeah, I mean, surprise won't be the first word. If we start to hear there's more tests, you know, positive, I'll just be so disappointed. We've come so far, and first of all, you want everyone's personal life and the safety, you know, their personal safety to be in check, but yeah, it's, you know, the optics weren't fantastic either. You know, Kelly McCrimmon and George McPhee, everyone's, you know, sitting there in the suite, no masks on, and in Vegas, and then coming to Montreal, and you know, the optics weren't good. And you know, we're not through this yet. I'd really hope, you know, we can survive the next 3 weeks, get through this without any more positive cases, and keep getting guys, you know, fully vaccinated, you know, inside and outside, you know, the fan base in the arena, and, you know, move forward in a better way. Because, you know, again, these aren't the storylines we want to be talking about, positive cases and officials. And I want to talk about the great hockey we're seeing and the great battles and the fact that we're down to four teams. And there's a lot of interesting storylines, but, you know, this is sort of the time we're in right now to have to deal with these other issues outside of the game.
No question. David Amber, Hockey Night in Canada, joining us here this morning on Rintoul and Sermon. All right, let's talk about that other series that resumes tonight, Game 5 between the Lightning and the New York Islanders. Has it been entertaining?
It's been competitive, and maybe that's a euphemism. You know, New York isn't there. You know, it's a results-oriented business. What I love to see back and forth, end-to-end action, you know, like we saw in a few of the Florida-Tampa games were phenomenal. We had a 6-5 game in that series. You know, sort of last-shot wins, great comebacks, and incredible offensive skill. You know, New York isn't built that way. That's not what they do. And surprisingly, they've scored a great number of goals this postseason, but they know their one chance against Tampa is to slow things down. It's not going to be a track meet. It's going to be, you know, really make the other team earn every inch of the ice, and it's going to be tight checking. And that's what we're seeing. Is that the most entertaining brand of hockey? No. No, it's not. And, you know, I don't think it's necessarily what everyone wants to see, but is it effective? And we've seen that it is effective. You know, they've eliminated Sid and Malkin. They've eliminated Marchand and passed them, the guys in Boston. And, you know, if they can somehow get past Kucherov and Point, my goodness, like, you know, they're sort of saying, we're a team, this is how we play, and you're going to adapt to our style. We're not going to adapt to your style. Would I love to see things open up a little bit? Yeah. And if Tampa gets on the power play a few times tonight, it might open up. It might, if Tampa has a 2-goal lead, New York's going to be forced to open things up. And then it might be a bit more of the track meet style that Tampa is very comfortable with. And New York has shown it can be comfortable with, but certainly they prefer to, you know, kind of pound you into the ground into a 2-1 game.
Yeah, so maybe it's that, or maybe it's that the Islanders get out to an early lead, because as soon as Tampa decided, okay, we have to let the reins off now, we're not going to play the patient game anymore, that was a pretty fun third period to watch, wasn't it?
It was, and that's a really good point, too, because Tampa, when they sort of say, okay, we need a goal, what are we going to do? They're more than capable of providing that. And they have so many good offensive weapons. I mean, what I think makes Tampa the best team, arguably, in the NHL is just that they can beat you any style you want to go. You know, if you want to open things up, they're comfortable doing that. Against Carolina, that wasn't the series we saw. We saw a very tight-knit series, a bunch of 2-1 and 2-0 style games, and Tampa came out on top. So they're comfortable any which way. But yeah, it would be very interesting if New York does score early, because they're not. This isn't a situation where you can sit on a lead, because Tampa won't allow you to do that. And boy, what we're seeing from Braden Point, by the way, you know, we started out this conversation, and I said I'd love to be talking about these great storylines and not the officials and COVID and everything else. Braden Point, there's few stories better than what he's doing right now. 7 straight games with a goal. He scored in, you know, all different sorts of fashions. Their game-winning goals, their rush chances, their, you know, grind them, you know, sort of grind it out, low crease type goals. He can do everything. It's really amazing. And, you know, it's funny, you look back to that RFA group back a couple years ago that was so talked about with Rantanen and Matthew Tkachuk and Mitch Marner and Aho. And, you know, Point, you got to give kudos to Tampa Bay. I believe Point came in at the lowest contract. I know he came in at the lowest contract of those guys. And, you know, right now, if you are putting all those guys up and sort of saying you can choose one, you know, there's a lot of GMs who probably would say, I'll take Braden Point. Top of that list, he's been that good, especially in the postseason.
He is likely to be on Team Canada, or at least a consideration for Team Canada, if the NHL goes to the Olympics next year. I saw the news dropping today that they're sending schedules out to teams right now. One of those schedules involves Olympic break. One of those schedules does not involve Olympic break. Where's your level of confidence that it will happen next year?
I think it will. I just think there's too many reasons for it to happen. I think there's a billion plus people in China, and that's an enticing, you know, potential revenue stream for the National Hockey League to want to open up their marketing to. I think there's no better way to market the game than to have the best players in the world on the ice. I think the players are incentivized to go there. They want to go. When you talk to players, the idea of them putting on their country's uniform at the biggest stage internationally to represent their country, that's very enticing to the players. The IOC, I think, would like to have, you know, and the International Ice Hockey Federation would like to have the NHL players there. So I think if everyone's on board, everyone's motivated, I think some of the logistical issues that kept them from going to Pyeongchang in 2018 don't exist here. So I do think it's sort of there's a lot of green lights ahead, and there should be all systems go. Of course, there's things that can happen, and quite namely, you know, number one problem maybe is this global pandemic, obviously, because there's those issues that are still around us. But I'd like to think that this will get sorted out, and I do believe it will. And I think it'll be an incredible showcase, and it'll be amazing. You know, just the amount of storylines about selecting the teams and who's the favorite, and you know, Canada obviously is generally going to be the favorite in these situations. But I mean, you look at some of the players out there for the American team and the Russian team and the Swedish team, and you go, wow, it could be very, very competitive. So it'll be really interesting to see.
David, Scott and I were talking before you came on air that the Seattle Kraken made a hire today, or an announcement of a hire. And no, it's not the head coach yet, but it's a great announcement in the fact that JT Brown is joining John Forslund on the broadcast team for the television side. You tweeted out about it here. Congratulations to him. What makes him a good fit for this position?
Well, he's a smart guy. He really analyzes the game at an elite level. He played the game at the highest level there is in the National Hockey League. He, you know, went to a Stanley Cup final with Tampa. He's well-respected and well-liked in the hockey community. It's great. And he gives a different perspective as well. You know, being a man of color, I think he's going to maybe see certain things through a different lens. And I think it's great that, you know, all different fans, whether what they look like or, you know, what their background is, can be represented and sort of see the game, you know, reflecting them a little bit. So I think it's good on all levels. And I think the Seattle Kraken should be really commended. You know, John Forslund, their play-by-play man that they hired, he's sensational as well. They've made a real point of sort of saying, we want to be the best of the best. We're going to try and get the best people possible. And I think they've really been a good blueprint for what a sort of a new franchise is going to be. And listen, the rivalry they're going to have with Vancouver is going to be sensational. I mean, I think that's just going to be a built-in day one, let's get at it. And certainly the Kraken might not have the same success that Vegas Golden Knights have had so quickly, but I just think they're going to be able to sort of build up a fan base and build up sort of an interest in their team from day one that's going to be really a great success story for the National Hockey League. So I'm really excited for them to get cracking, I guess you can say, in October.
Yeah, we've all made the joke so far, and I think we've all applauded many of the hires along the way. It feels like, David, and you tell me if you agree with this, it feels like every time they've made an announcement, whether it's the unveiling of the name, the jersey, the logo, the different hires along the way, it's either been a home run or a triple or a double, but they haven't missed yet, have they?
It doesn't seem that way. And, you know, they've been very thoughtful in their approach. I've talked with Todd Lewicki, and they're reaching out to different people to try and get a sense of what are the best ways to do things. You know, they want to be the best, right? They don't just want to be another team. You know, they're putting this great arena, this great facility together. It's going to be state-of-the-art. And, you know, again, you mentioned even the JT Brown hiring. I mean, there's someone I worked, you know, in the fan inclusion committee with the National Hockey League. JT was on that board as well. And he brought such great ideas, you know, about how to make the game bigger and better for everyone, more inclusive, more diverse, you know, more different, you know, approaches to the game that maybe traditionally have been ignored or just overlooked on some level. So I'm very excited for him to hear his voice and for him to have that, you know, that space to talk. It just speaks again to Seattle really going above and beyond and just saying we really want to make our fan experience unique, and we want to make sure it's a great time and grows really from the grassroots up in the community. So I think it's going to be fantastic. I'm really excited. And, you know, the Kraken, it's still taking me time to get used to the name. I love the color scheme and the jersey and everything else, but the Kraken will take a little bit of time, but it is growing on me. The first day I was like, oh my goodness, but it is growing on me now.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And speaking of excitement, I was excited to hear you on the latest edition of 31 Thoughts, the podcast. I was even more excited when you had an over-the-top reference hearkening back to your arm wrestling days. Like Sly Stallone in that movie, did you have a trucker ball cap that you turned around every time that you had an arm wrestling match?
First of all, let's get this clear. I don't have an arm wrestling background. I had one night where I got in. Elliot basically forced me, belittled me into coming on the podcast and kind of embarrassing myself with this crazy story of having this arm wrestle. It was all in relation, if you haven't heard the podcast, it was all in relation to what happened with Jeff Petrie with those, you know, the crazy blood vessel popping in his eye. And I said to Elliot, we're watching the game, and I said, oh my God, look at that. That's horrific. And I said, you know, that actually happened to me in one eye. And he said, how did that happen to you? And I explained I was in these arm wrestles, and I guess I was overexerting myself and like literally clenching my face so tight in this arm wrestle that I popped some blood vessels in my eye. And he thought it was hilarious. I didn't think it was so funny, but he was like, that is a great story. You've got to share that story. And I was like, okay. So here we are. But no, I didn't have the Sly Stallone look or anything like that going. And now I've been, you know, conned into this whole get an arm wrestle with Kevin BX in the future. So now this is not going to go well for me. But oh well, what can you do?
You've got a year to train. You've got a year to train for. There's going to be charity money on the table, according to what you guys laid out, or at least Elliot laid out and sort of roped you into. But it was a great story. I enjoyed it. And no word of a lie, as things have started to open up out here in the West, first softball game a couple of weeks ago, we had a discussion about over the top at that game. So I was thrilled that you were at least in the exact same parlance that I've been using here lately.
Oh, that is funny, because I haven't thought about that movie in a long, long time. But, oh, that's funny. That's an old school reference. I'm glad you guys are out there playing softball. We're slowly but surely getting things going here in Ontario as well, and it is good. It really is important. First day of summer, here we go. Let's, you know, trying in a safe way get our lives back in order. So it's really good to hear.
Amen. And thank you very much for your time once again. I'm glad you had a great weekend. We'll do this again soon, David. All the best.
Thanks,
David.
Yeah. Karen, Scott, thank you guys for having me on, and stay safe and enjoy the games.
You as well. That is David Amber, and I'm not sure all of our listeners caught that, but I was listening to the 31 Thoughts podcast over the weekend, and that's why Elliot and Jeff brought David on to tell this story about bursting a blood vessel in his eye. He only did it in one eye as opposed to Jeff Petrie, who had it in both, and we talked about that a lot last week, and so that's why Amber was on there talking about his over-the-top arm wrestling days.
I'll have to go back and listen to that story. I didn't catch that one, Scott. But it's like, what's the common for whatever hemorrhaging bilateral, whatever it is, conjunctive hemorrhaging bilateral in his eyes? It's coughing hard or sneezing hard. Those are the two common things. But I guess you could put in the Wikipedia page or trying really hard at arm wrestling.
Yep. Put it in there. David Amber, living proof of it. It's Scott Rentoul. It's Karen Sermon. We'll make the turn on the show here, and we will play your comments into this as well. A lot of you have weighed in. I want to get those on the air. And also this, outside of the officiating, what was the moment of the weekend on ice? It's next on Rentoul and Sermon.